I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news for you. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us, and you can tell us about the educators who inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight by emailing us with your nominations at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And today on the show, we are talking with Blakely Mangini. She's the Education and Community Engagement Director at the Rockford Symphony Youth Orchestra. They're an ensemble made up of around 50 middle and high school students from across northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, and Blakely calls it a training orchestra where students play challenging, high-level orchestra music, but in a fun, lower-stress environment.
That's one of the beautiful things about a youth orchestra is that, like, it's kind of come one, come all. In the stereotypical symphonic orchestra professional level, there would be, like, one English horn player. But in the youth orchestra, we're kind of like, yeah, we can have five English horns. That's okay. Like, because it's their opportunity to learn and grow. And so we're not about to turn people away.
Blakely's job is to help encourage students to be part of the program and help encourage the public to support the youth orchestra. She's a music teacher. She's been doing private lessons as long as she can remember, and she's also played professionally herself, playing viola in string quartets around the Midwest. We get into all of that and so much more here on Teacher's Lounge, but first, we've got a few more education stories we want to share. Illinois lawmakers are considering legislation that would allow community colleges to offer bachelor's degrees for particular in-demand programs, and I got to talk to rural community college students who say they'd really benefit if it passes. Near the end of his budget address this year, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker asked a community college student in the crowd to stand up.
Melissa wants to pursue a baccalaureate degree in nursing, but the cost and the commute to a school farther away will make it too expensive.
The governor said there are students like Melissa all over Illinois, and the state should help them.
And that's why I'm proposing that we allow community colleges to offer four-year baccalaureate degrees for in-demand career paths. Nursing, advanced manufacturing, early childhood education, and beyond.
Illinois wouldn't be the first state to allow community colleges to offer four-year degrees. 24 states already do, and almost all of them include requirements the school has to meet before they can start. In Illinois, community colleges would have to prove there's an unmet workforce need they can meet, offer evidence that they have the financial resources and staff to provide it, and demonstrate that they're not duplicating a program already offered at a school in their district. For example, community colleges wouldn't offer a psychology or elementary education degree.
Those kind of programs really are the bread and butter of the universities. They do them so well. It's the targeted really to a different population who otherwise is not going to get a degree. And we've seen that in Illinois.
That's Tracy Morris. She's the president of Illinois Valley Community College in Oglesby. And she says this would be a seismic shift.
When you are where we are and there's not a college for an hour away, the default reaction is we'll just do online. But it's not always the best learning.
And for students who work full-time or have kids, commuting that far or moving is just not an option. It's something Michael Jenkins has been thinking about. He's an advanced manufacturing student at Sauk Valley Community College in Dixon. He just graduated with a credential and re-enrolled to take even more classes. He also works full-time as an electronics technician at a company that makes diesel parts.
So we have big, huge, heavy coolers. My job is to maintain production lines, keep machines running, and keep making parts.
He's planning to transfer to NIU for his bachelor's degree so he can transition from the production floor to an engineering position, but because of his work demands, that's not going to be for a few years.
My current plan would require me to either commute over an hour to get to NIU or to actually relocate. But if it's all at Sauk, I really don't have to do anything. I can kind of just stay where I am, do what I'm doing.
He says Sauk already has a close relationship with local manufacturing, so it would make sense to build on that with a four-year program.
The things you're doing in your classes are very much what you're going to end up doing on your job. So it is very focused, very specific.
Jenkins says there are a lot of people in his rural community who want to stay and work these jobs, but just don't have the opportunity. And he says employers know that if you leave to go to school at NIU or another university, it's unlikely you'll come back. Samantha Feather is about to graduate from Sauk Valley's nursing program.
I think that it would be amazing for all of us that are graduating this year and to come, really.
She says most of her classmates are thinking about doing their bachelor's degree online, but this bill would allow them the flexibility to stay in person with the instructors they trust while also working the floor at a local hospital. And one of the big selling points of attending community colleges is the lower tuition costs. And with that in mind, the legislation limits the costs of the four-year programs. The price can't be more than 150% higher than the two-year programs they offer. The Community College Bachelor's Degree bill is currently in the House Rules Committee. It has more than 50 co-sponsors, including half a dozen Republican lawmakers. Now, and also, Illinois used federal COVID funding for a high-impact tutoring program. That funding expired in the fall, and many schools say tutoring made a big difference, but can they keep it going without that federal money?
Your next point will be at 8-1.
In the library of Hiawatha Elementary School, students use crayons to connect points on a graph. They don't know it yet, but they're drawing a big pirate ship.
We are pirating, not in the illegal way. We're pirating in the fun math way.
That's Lily Smith, the third grade teacher running the activity. It's part of their Crazy Eights after school math program where they're trying to make math more fun. Today, they're pirates learning about the X and Y axes, and on Tuesday, they were cow farmers learning perimeter and area. And Hiawatha Elementary School was part of the state's high impact tutoring program from 2022 all the way through last summer. Once the federal funding expired, Principal Caitlin Bennis wanted to find a way to keep tutoring because she says they were seeing results.
We were seeing students be able to not only grow on those benchmark assessments, but also on the in-class regular skills that they're learning at their grade level.
But there were two major obstacles to continuing it. One, they weren't sure they could afford it, and two, they didn't have the staff for it.
I couldn't figure it out. So all first semester, we went back and forth. We settled with, we can't do it, but we also aren't okay with doing nothing.
That's how they came to Crazy Eights. It may not be high-impact tutoring, but it's something to help students stay engaged and make math less scary.
If they're scared, they tend not to take academic risks. Right? That's if we're scared, we hold ourselves back.
Nancy Wamack is with the National Student Support Accelerator at Stanford University. She's the lead author of a new brief that analyzes tutoring efforts in every state.
I would say that the Illinois program is actually a little more structured and has more partnerships built in.
Now with states and individual districts weighing how to fund tutoring programs, Wamack says it's important to make sure it's still high impact. She says if it's diluted to save money and students meet in larger groups or it happens less often, there will be less academic benefit.
It's individualized instruction, and we know that that is an effective approach for students. Teachers do it every time they go over to a student and help them along and make sure they know exactly what's happening in the class.
She says you shouldn't think of tutoring as an add-on, but as something integral to the learning experience. So far, Wamack says only one state, Tennessee, has made tutoring a permanent part of their education funding formula, but others are using grants. Illinois has yet to provide any grant or formula funding for tutoring. Mike Balestri is the principal at Lincoln Elementary School in Oglesby, and they also participated in the Illinois Tutoring Initiative.
We looked at it like a win-win situation for us. We'd be able to provide some tutoring support for, you know, really no cost to the district at that time.
The program paid their own teachers to do the tutoring. It grew slowly at first, but by last year, they were tutoring 30 kids, which is a lot at a small rural school. Like Bennis, Balestri says their program was paying dividends.
What we saw a lot of progress in was our own district testing in kids that were getting up much closer to grade level than I feel like they would not have been able to make some of those gains without the program.
So when the pandemic era money went away, just like at Hiawatha, he wanted the tutoring initiative to continue. But Balestri says they went to their superintendent and school board and were able to pull enough money together to keep it going.
We needed to continue something. We had to now make the investment as a district. We have really continued to operate a very similar tutoring program this school year.
In fact, they were able to expand it. The previous program was for third through fifth graders. Now, second graders can get tutoring too. Balestri hopes they can keep it up for as long as possible, because even though the tutoring program initially came about to help students overcome pandemic-era learning gaps, he says additional individualized instruction is always useful to have. And if the state could step in to help pay for it, this type of support wouldn't be limited to just the schools who can afford it. All right, now it is time for my conversation with the Rockford Symphony Youth Orchestra's Blakely Mangini, and we start off talking about how she's liking this relatively new gig. Have you had any moments so far, you know, in your first like 9 months in the role where you're like, yes, this is exactly what I was hoping this was going to be?
We actually had kind of a success story this past weekend. We had our RSO at the arcade concert, so that was like video game music, and we did a collab with a big band as well. And part of my task for that concert was to organize this Super Smash tournament in the lobby before the concert. And
did you compete? Did you compete in it?
I did not compete. My husband likes to play Super Smash very casually, but I am definitely not in the know with like tournament rules and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So we partnered with Rockford University and they facilitated this amazing tournament for us and had a really young turnout, which was very fun. You know, the orchestra audience is generally older.
The symphony audience and the Super Smash Bros are, because you're telling me they're not two concentric circles of the Venn diagram?
Yeah, so that was probably my most recent success story.
But really quick, for people who just like don't know much about, you know, obviously there's the Rockford Symphony Orchestra and there's the Rockford Symphony Youth Orchestra, the youth part about this, which is, you know, not just students from Rockford either. This is students across kind of Northern Illinois, Southern Wisconsin, the whole area, right?
Yeah, they come from all over. We have a few over 40 right now as a part of the Youth Symphony.
And so people like audition to be a part of it, and then it's kind of a train. Just like, what does it look like for folks who like want to be a part of it?
Yeah, it's an audition-based ensemble. So we have auditions coming up at the end of May 31st. Students can audition. We'll take anyone basically ages 14 through 21 who play an instrument. And it is a high-level ensemble. So we're looking for students who are really devoted to their instrument and instrument learning. The experience of being in the orchestra, they're playing real symphonic repertoire. We call it like a training orchestra, where they get the experience of playing symphonic music. They get experience in leading their section, whoever those section leaders are, and kind of the ownership level of like, you're expected to, you know, do your best in every rehearsal and really participate in that greater goal.
Yeah. Were you a part of something like that when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did play with a, I always called it a little kid orchestra. It wasn't the level of RSYO. It was kind of like a starter orchestra to get string students some experience before they would join a youth symphony.
My first orchestra. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that. And then I went on to play with the Kishwaukee Symphony in DeKalb. And so that I did, you know, as soon as I was ready to graduate from the air quote little kid orchestra, I joined Kishwaukee and played with them all through high school.
Yeah, that's fascinating that, like, you know, where it is still a, you know, beginner training ground, but you are playing this, you know, very serious, very high level music.
Yeah, definitely. So the training part of it is really like that experience of playing that repertoire without maybe the risk of losing your job, right? But, you know,
yeah, I guess that's a good weight to not have over you. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the environment is one where we understand that all of these students are learning. And so to expect perfection is kind of a lackluster goal, but really we're expecting progress and everyone trying their best and learning together.
But that's a mindset that you can get into, right? When you're playing that type of music, is striving for perfection.
Yeah, definitely. I've always found that perfection is not a very motivating goal, because you feel like you'll never get there. And so you lose motivation to get there. At least I do. But if your goals are a little bit more attainable, then something as horrible as perfection.
Yeah, it could be stressful. And I think that probably, you know, if people burn out, that's probably one of the big reasons why, I would think.
Yeah, totally.
And so you guys have events that are going on pretty much all the time and some concerts that are coming up too, right?
Yeah. So the Youth Symphony runs during the school year. They get the summer off. We do kind of a kickoff in August that we call it like their camp day. So it's like an intensive all day, lots of rehearsals and games and, you know, that kind of kickoff for the year. But we are now, since we're at the end of the season, we're approaching their last concert. So that one is May 4th. It's easy to remember because they're going to play some Star Wars. So May the 4th be with you.
You just had to, right?
I mean, I had to.
Two of the notes.
Too good. But yeah, on May 4th at 3 o'clock at the Belvedere Performing Arts Center, they'll be playing their spring concert. So this is kind of the culmination of all of their work all year long. And we have these kind of goalposts as the year goes on. This will be the fourth and final concert. So in my opinion, it's really them showcasing all the things that they've learned all year long and incorporating those.
So it really is the kind of the, you know, to borrow a term, the crescendo of the whole year's work.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
How are they excited about the, like, playing Star Wars stuff? Like, does the you know, playing John Williams music, does that connect with if you're a kid like 14 now as much as it did like maybe 20 25 years ago?
Yeah, I think so. I think that music is, you know, so cool, and it's not just Star Wars. They're doing a whole program of movie music, so I think that it's always fun to play, and maybe it's a little bit scary for the strings because I know some of those parts are really difficult, and I think that's a really cool part about them playing all this film music is people don't know how difficult it is. It takes a high level to pull off like Harry Potter. They're playing some Harry Potter and, you know, those things are really advanced. So I'm really proud of the work they've put in.
I feel like that could be an easy entry point for a lot of people into this type of like orchestra music, whether it be, you know, like you said, Star Wars or Harry Potter, things like that. I think a lot of people who think that they don't have much of a connection with like orchestra music will also be like, I love like those iconic film scores, or like I was playing like Legend of Zelda the other day and it was just like the most beautiful orchestral music, and you're like, oh, I guess I really do have a connection to this, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the programming is a wonderful entry point. Also, we were able to make this concert free for everyone to attend. So that's another way to make this an entry point into the symphony orchestra experience, that you don't have to pay to get in. So even if you're just slightly interested, it's literally no cost to check it out and to come hear these students play.
Yeah. So speaking of like entry points in, what was the entry point into not just orchestra, but, you know, music for and playing music for you? I know that we mentioned that you're from Northern Illinois. You're from out in Carroll County, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know more about me than I do.
Listen, that's, I hope not. But yeah. So like, I was curious again, like I grew up in a small town in Northern Illinois. You grew up in a small town in Northern Illinois. I'm curious, like, how did you get involved in music? Is it something that your whole family did, or was it something that was unique to you, or how did that start out?
Music education was definitely something that my parents valued. My parents are non-musicians. They both dabbled in instruments growing up, but they really just valued that for their kids. So I have three older siblings, and all of them studied music. So it was just kind of expected at our house that, you know, you'll take piano lessons and then you'll pick another instrument.
Were you excited about it going in? Because, like, I also, I'm the youngest of four. I have three older siblings as well. And, like, I had that kind of contrarian gene where, like, if they were doing everything, I was like, I want to do the exact opposite. So or did you want to follow in the footsteps, or was there a little bit of resistance early on?
I don't remember any resistance. It just felt so ingrained into our culture at our house that, you know, like, I just kind of thought kids play piano. That's just something everybody does, so I'm going to do it too. And when it came time to pick another instrument, I was thinking that I would play flute. I don't know why, that was just kind of capturing my attention. And I ended up meeting Ann Smelser, who she is the wife of Link Smelser. Link Smelser is our conductor of the youth orchestra. So I met her when I was a kid, and she said, are you going to learn an instrument? And I said, yeah, I think flute. And she said, oh, but you're so tall and your arms are long, you should play viola.
Like, she was scouting you for, like, a basketball team? She's like, look at that wingspan, we got to get you on the viola.
Yep. So I was like, okay, I'll do viola. And so I ended up taking viola lessons with her all through high school. So that's been a really fun part about coming back to the Rockford area, is getting to see Ann and Link Smelter again. And I work so closely with Link now with the youth orchestra. So it feels like it's kind of come full circle, like the start of my music beginnings, and then also like helping other students in this area get started with music too.
Oh, that is really, that must have been a pretty surreal full circle thing for you over the last year or so.
Definitely.
And so it was, you know, I know that often for people who, you know, grow up playing music and then continue to pursue that professionally, that like teaching music and then like, you know, okay, well, I'm going to do this, and then I'm also going to like teach lessons to kids or to up and coming students, kind of becomes a natural part of it for a lot of people. Is it something that for you, did teaching music, was that always not just something that you did, but something that you were passionate about? Or was it something that later on you kind of learned to appreciate the teaching music part of it?
Question. I feel like I've taught private lessons for as long as I can remember. Like, I think there were, you know, friends of mine that wanted to learn how to play viola or violin, and I remember teaching them like when I was in high school. And I, you know, I wouldn't say my professional teaching career began when I was in high school, but it's just always kind of been a part of my journey, is helping others learn an instrument too. But I definitely became more interested in teaching music during grad school. That's when I started studying the Suzuki method, which is sort of what I grew up in.
What is the Suzuki method, if you don't
know?
Sure.
So in a nutshell, the Suzuki method is a philosophy of music learning that originally started with violin, but now has expanded to other instruments like flute, piano, harp, all the string instruments. But this philosophy is that talent is developed, that talent is not inborn. So anyone can learn, and the best way to learn is through the, Suzuki himself would call it the mother tongue method. So learning by ear, not reading music immediately, but instead learning through like inspiration and imitation. So typically for this to work best, a student would start when they're like 3 or 4 years old.
Right. Like similar to learning a language or something like that.
Yes, exactly. So it's modeled after language learning, where, you know, reading comes much later than speaking and understanding words. So, you know, a baby would understand the words first, then they would start with imitation of small syllables, ma, 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 and do that for a long time. And then eventually piece those syllables together to make coherent sentences. And then reading comes much later than that. And then you're reading at a lower level than you're able to speak too. So that kind of aligns with the Suzuki method also.
Right. And so learning about that in grad school kind of unlocked something for teaching for you too then?
Yeah, definitely. That's when I thought like teaching is always going to be a part of my life. And I got so fascinated with like the building blocks of what we do as musicians, and and how to communicate those to new learners.
Yeah, it's something that I think is fascinating about learning and teaching music, that actually we just had someone on the show a couple weeks ago who is, studied music all the way through college, but doesn't do it professionally anymore, but talks about just the skills that music teaches, that he's like, I just feel like being a musician, that kind of skill set that you learn to learn music helps you so much in other aspects of your life and just helps you be successful in kind of whatever else you're doing. I'm curious if that's something that you've thought about too.
I definitely agree with that. I feel like that's the reason that people should study music, not necessarily to become professional musicians, but for the skills that it fosters. That's kind of part of the Suzuki method as well, that learning in music creates better people. And I think that's so fascinating, and I definitely believe it. And there are also these tangible skills like time management. I think people who practice an instrument regularly have to become practiced at time management or self-discipline or like attention to detail. Like the higher you go in music learning, the more you're listening with intense detail. And so I can't help but carry that over into other avenues of my life, for better or worse.
Well, I think I think I saw a video too where you were talking about that, like the skills that music taught you about like creativity and also just like teamwork, especially like if you're talking about a symphony and performances like that.
Yeah, definitely.
I think about it a lot from like, I didn't grow up playing music. Again, it was a situation where I said I had an older brother who played the piano, and I was like, screw that, I'm gonna do the opposite, I can't do it. So, and I was like, I grew up playing sports primarily, so playing like baseball and basketball stuff, and so I think it gave me a very like competitive win-lose mindset. And I was thinking about, I actually just went to a family member's like school choir and like play, because I went to a couple performances. And just like the joy that was around it, I was like, oh my God, I like wish that I had done that more when I was a kid, because it felt like a completely different thing. Where like, obviously there is like, you know, the performance can go well or it can go not as well. Like you said, like, you know, sometimes we get very deep into perfectionism, trying to make sure that we get everything completely correct. But there was something that struck me about it, about just the teamwork about it, that just like at the end of the day, people leave and they're all going to be really happy. It's not like one of those games where, you know, you lose a baseball game 15-1 and you're 12 years old and you're like, oh God.
Yeah, I think it comes back to mindset for me, for sure. And I remember, I'm not a very athletic person, and I played a little softball when I was a kid. And I remember coming back from a practice and crying to my mom and saying, can you believe they actually want to win? Because in my approach to sports, I thought, it should be for the fun of it, and it should be for the teamwork of it. And we're playing a game, so shouldn't the emphasis be on playing? And I like could not comprehend that the emphasis was going to be on winning. So I think, yeah, the joy of playing music together, I think that's something that the students in RSYO really enjoy. When I ask for, you know, feedback, like how's your year been going? They always talk about the friends that they've made in the orchestra. And for a lot of them, it's their first experience of, like, I keep saying symphonic orchestra, but like that combination of winds and brass and strings all together. For most of them in their schools, it's kind of separated, like strings will be in orchestra and winds and brass will be in band. So they get to dabble in that teamwork of like working with other instrument families too. And the blend of sound, I think that's where they can use a lot of creativity.
You know, one of the things that we talk a lot about on this show is about the, you know, teachers you've had who inspired you. And you talked about how coming back, you've had a full circle moment with some of the people who, you know, you first started learning music from. So I was curious for you, you know, you can name names. You don't have to name names if you don't want to, but just any educators you've had in your life that really you feel like helped get you to where you are today?
Yeah, that's so easy for me. It would be all of my viola teachers. So I've had 4 total. Ann Smelter was my first viola teacher, so from ages 10 through 18. Victoria Lombard, I studied with her in my undergrad. Tony DeFois in my master's program, and then Sally Chisholm in my DMA studies. And the ability to work one-on-one with a teacher, I think, is the best part of going to school for music. That you have, like, you have a champion in your corner no matter what, and someone that's advocating for you. And I don't, you know, I've only ever studied music in school and in higher ed, so I don't know what other people's experience is like in other departments, but like, when you study a musical instrument, you're built in into your program this one-on-one interaction regularly with your teacher, and they end up being your advisor, and they end up being your friend and your reference later in life. And like, I just owe so much of my career to those 4 teachers.
Yeah. I'm always curious about, then, you know, obviously you have those teachers, and you're a teacher yourself and you've taught music for a long time. I'm always curious about how much, you know, not only obviously having those teachers, but being a teacher, teaching music yourself, how that changes you as a musician, the way that you play music or the way that you approach it.
Yeah, I think for me, it's probably changed the way that I practice the most. To switch roles, right? Like, if you're a student and your teacher is telling you to practice, you do it because they're telling you to, or at least, I don't know. I don't have that contrarian bone in me that you mentioned. So maybe that didn't work for you, but it worked for me to have a teacher ask me to practice, then I would. But the minute you like graduate from school or it's summer break or something, and no one's telling you to practice, and suddenly that voice has to come from inside, I feel like that really developed for me when I started teaching, where I thought like, oh, I can be my own teacher also, like through this whole process. And like, just because someone's a teacher doesn't mean they're the ultimate expert authority also. Like, teachers are learning too. Right. And so I think that has definitely guided my own musicianship, is like, be my own teacher and always be curious.
Yeah. And again, I know that, you know, we mentioned that you studied music in college, you've played professionally for all across the Midwest. How much in your current role do you get to play?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I have my day job is working for the Rockford Symphony, education director. And then I play with a string quartet in kind of the southern Wisconsin area, Madison, Milwaukee-ish. And we do performances pretty regularly. So I'm still able to play chamber music, which is my favorite avenue of performing. String quartet specifically is my ultimate favorite music to perform. So I'm really lucky that I'm able to balance both of those things.
What is it about it, you think, that connects with you so deeply?
Part of the fun is the spontaneity, where, like, in my case, a string quartet, 4 people, we get to decide in the moment what will happen with the music. Whereas like if it's a larger group and there's a conductor, the conductor is kind of guiding where the music is going to go, and the players have to react to that. But in chamber music, there's a larger sense of ownership where like I can do something with my viola and it will change the course of what we're doing as a group. So I find it really fun, and you just kind of never know what's going to happen in a good way.
Right, which again seems like one of those, you have to know the rules in order to be able to break them in
totally.
That situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I've studied with the Ariana Quartet in the past. They are in St. Louis, and they would always say, you don't practice to do things a certain way, you practice so that you can do things 100 different ways. And like in the practice room, you're trying out many different options for each thing that you play.
Yeah. And so what's the name of your quartet?
Kalara with a K.
There's a couple questions that we always like to ask near the end. First of all, actually, before we get into that, I am curious. You mentioned that like your whole family played music, like all of your siblings and everything. Do they still play music?
Yes. Most of them are teaching music more than performing. So the oldest two sisters are twins, and they both studied harp. So if you can imagine my home growing up, we had two harps going all the time.
Wow, the dual harps. That's
yeah, weird. Dual harps. So one of them performs like more like church music, not so much harp, but singing and playing piano and that sort of thing at her church. The other one is teaching full-time piano at a charter school. So like I said earlier, we all learned piano too. So they're keeping up their piano chops more than I am. And then my middle sister is a cellist, and she's really active in freelancing and teaching in the Nashville area.
Wow. Did you guys ever get to perform like all four of you?
Yeah. Growing up, we would do lots of like weddings and special events and that kind of thing. Like,
oh my gosh, really?
Cello and viola.
Wow. So it's no wonder that you're in quartets now, right? Like you just are naturally a group in groups of four.
Yeah. That's true.
That's awesome. What's something about teaching more generally, not just teaching music, but what's just something about teaching that you just think is more important than people might realize that goes into it?
The first word that pops into my head is relationship. So I think like in education, things are kind of shifting from an older approach, which is that like empty vessel, right, that we're like pouring into our students and teaching them everything that we know. And I feel like that's all sort of shifting into this more collaborative, like students have something to bring to the table too. And teachers.
Yeah, nobody wants to be an empty vessel.
Yeah. I think that's a thing of the past. Like no one is an empty vessel. So everyone's bringing something to the table. And I think the only way for teaching of any type to be really effective is if there is that relationship in place, really prioritizing trust. So like to be a trustworthy person, I think is a huge responsibility of teachers.
Yeah. And we'll have something more specific, which is just what's something, and I think that it maybe ties into the conversation that we had about the kind of skills that you get from music that aren't necessarily music specific, but just things about, you know, teaching or learning music that you wish more people knew about.
I wish that more people knew that everyone has the ability to make music, and that it's not specifically for this like small percentage of people who are air quote musically talented, or that it's like in their DNA, but really everyone can learn music if they want to. Everyone can learn an instrument or learn to listen more or to kind of cultivate a musical taste that they like. I think it really is for everyone. And you don't have to have a talent gene or something like that.
Right. I don't know if that's a stigma thing that you have to break down when you're doing, you know, youth orchestra work too, or symphonies, right? Is that like, I think for some people, they do grow up thinking that like, you know, symphony and orchestra is this very like small elite thing that like normal people can't do or enjoy, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the beautiful things about a youth orchestra is that like, it's kind of come one, come all. And if we end up like in the stereotypical symphonic orchestra professional level, there would be like one English horn player. But in the youth orchestra, we're kind of like, yeah, we can have five English horns. That's okay. Like, because it's their opportunity to learn and grow. And so we're not about to turn people away because we have multiples of a particular instrument.
Bring all your English horns.
Yeah.
We got room for it.
We need violas right now.
We do need Viola. Well, I mean, listen, you seem like the perfect person to be sending that message out then.
Go Violas.
That's it. Yeah. If you're interested in violin, but you've got the wingspan, you got to think about viola then, right?
Yep.
I have to ask too then, as we get off there, I won't ask you. I know that you've probably get a million times in your life people asking you what the difference between a violin and viola is and all that. I won't put you through that. You've probably had to do that way too many times in your life. I'll do it in the intro. It's a little bit bigger. It's a little bit bigger. It's a little bit, you know, lower. That's about the long and short of it. But just really quick, if you want to just sing the praises of the viola really quick, why you love it, why you think, since we do need more people, why people should think about it.
Yeah, I think the viola is such a beautiful sounding instrument, since it's kind of that middle range in the string family, very soulful, and it can be kind of dark sounding sometimes, which I really love. And then the parts that we get to play, yeah, we don't always get to play the melody like the violins do, but there's something really special about that kind of inner voice part that the viola plays, where we get to control the mood of the music. So whether it's a happy sounding piece, we're playing notes that sound happy, or a sad sounding piece, we're kind of making those minor chords happen with those inner voices. So I think the violas hold a lot of power in any ensemble, and for me that's really fun.
I think that's your sales pitch. I think it's viola : control the mood of the music. I think that's it. That was my conversation with the Rockford Symphony Youth Orchestra's Blakely Mangini. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, you can feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Blakely. You could send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And wherever you're hearing the podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, or share. It's the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. You could also subscribe to our newsletter to keep up to date with everything going on with the show. You can do that over at wnij.org. And I've been your host, Peter Medlin, and we'll be back with even more Teacher's Lounge very soon. But for now, let's have the Rockford Symphony Youth Orchestra play us out.